Our next speaker is also well known, I think, to everyone here, Dr. Ernest Vandenhaag, who is both a professor and a practicing psychoanalyst in New York City. I suppose this is a good combination if you're going to live anywhere in New York nowadays. It may not be necessary, but at least it certainly is helpful. As you know, he's the author of several books again. His latest book, in fact, is The Jewish Mystique, which I think is well on its way to becoming a bestseller, in fact. Let's help it along a bit. Also, Passion and Social Constraint, The Fabric of Society, and Education as an Industry. One of his articles on the student revolt, student seizures, as it's called, is available over here at the desk in Modern Age, the summer-fall issue of 1970. without taking up any more time, I'll just I'll let you have Dr. Vandenhaag now. That is, to have his speech.
I'm glad about this last qualification. I will not go into such profound physical and metaphysical things as my predecessor did. I noticed that there are very few females here, so I'm tempted to take their part, but I hope the few that are here will properly respond to what I have to say on sexual discrimination. In all known societies, the differences between the sexes are socially elaborated. That is, the biological differences lead, in the first place, to society assigning maternal and paternal roles beyond what is required simply by physiology. Women not only bear, but usually also bring up children to a far greater extent than men. This is incidentally least so perhaps in our society, where there are a number of males who take care of children far more so than is the case in most other societies. We have male pediatricians, male teachers, and so on. In all societies also, males and females are assigned somewhat different economic roles. The role division in distribution differs from society to society, but that there is a differentiation in all societies. Although the kind of differentiation differs. In some, I'm tempted to say ideal societies, women do all the work. in most, the tasks are just differently assigned. On the whole, and in general, women doing this more domestic and agricultural types of tasks, males doing the more such things as hunting, fighting, and so on. But there are, as I said, great differentiations in this. Together with these role differential role distributions, there's also usually a differential distribution of prestige. Again, here, this differs very greatly. In some societies, women are simply chattel. In others, prestige is fairly evenly distributed. In most societies, males have somewhat higher prestige than females. But the kind and the normative regulations connected with this differ from society to society. All of it shows that there is a social elaboration of physical differences. In practically all societies, there are also power and income differences, again, usually in favor of males. These differences, all of those that I have mentioned, are probably minimized in our society. At least I don't know of any other society where they were as small and where the role distribution was as flexible as it is in ours. From what I have just said, it follows that biological differences can be elaborated greatly, but needn't be elaborated in any specific way, except for certain minimal requirements. Yet historically, it seems clear that all societies that are on the historical record have been patriarchal, that is, with males predominating. Mildly so or strongly so. Even in Roman law, you still had familia id est patrimonium, that is, the man's family was basically entirely at his disposal. Again, in our society, this patriarchy is probably least. Let me point out that this, of course, involves discrimination, but we should distinguish two types of discrimination. In the literal etymological sense of discrimination, it means simply distinction. And of course, distinctions are entirely acceptable. The controversy arises about whether there is a distinction or discrimination that places a group or a person at a disadvantage not warranted by the situation, merely because of his group membership. So to speak of discrimination in the political sense involves not just a distinction, but a distinction disadvantageous to a group which is not warranted by the situation. In other words, if you distinguish between, or according to a criterion which is inappropriate to the situation. Of course, if you grade students in a classroom, you make a distinction, and some get good grades and some get bad grades. This is, however, warranted by the situation, provided that the criterion you apply is appropriate, namely their achievement in the work at hand, and not their sex, age, weight, fortune, or anything else. In the United States, I think, more than in any other country, I should think, we have a fairly individualized role distribution and a fairly full legal equality. I will come to a few exceptions in a moment. Now, we have to explain in some way why, throughout history, there has been a patriarchal society. Let me point out incidentally, that a number of anthropologists, particularly Bachofen, and to some extent in this country, Louis Morgan, and based on him later on, Friedrich Engels, were under the of the opinion that patriarchy was preceded by a matriarchy. There's simply no evidence for that whatsoever. And that's the end of that. And I don't know of any modern anthropologist who accepts this hypothesis. You find in Kate Millay's book, incidentally, Sexual Politics, a great deal of stuff based on Engels, and she takes a very peculiar position. She says, well, of course, this isn't really accepted, but, and then she goes right on explaining everything that is explained. But I don't know of Engels' mistake was entirely admissible at his, in his time. Anthropologists held an evolutionary view of society developed in regular stages and so on. Bachofen's ideas on matriarchy and so on were not as were not regarded as eccentric as they are today for various reasons. The evidence simply was not as complete. Today, I don't know of any anthropologist taking this stuff seriously, so I except perhaps Robert Graves, but he's a poet. When you then have to concede that history gives us only patriarchal societies, the word patriarchy here, including all kinds of social orders, provided there's some sort of degree of male predominance in some form or other, then you have to ask yourself how to explain this. There are basically only two explanations available. Either you assume there's some sort of universal conspiracy of man extending from prehistory to this day and all over the world, which is the view that Kate Millay more or less, I say more or less because she never quite admits it, it seems a little too absurd, and it was after all a PhD thesis, but on the other hand, she never quite denies it either and more or less suggests it throughout. This is one view. The other view is, of course, that there are actual differences, physiological and psychological, that may possibly explain, at least in part, what has happened. Now, as to the conspiracy theory, let me very briefly point out that the major evidence that is adduced for it is simply that males do predominate, and that they often justify their predominance with arguments which are patently false. But let me point out that this argument, that males predominate, that is, most of our executives, leading politicians, leading scholars, leading everything, are male, and disproportionately so, this argument is not, it seems to me, evidence for any sort of conspiracy, because it confuses that which is to be explained, the explicandum, with the explanation. In other words, what is to be explained is that males predominate, and you don't explain it by saying, evidence for conspiracy consists of the fact that males predominate. In other words, you have to explain independently that this is a conspiracy rather than something else. And let me point out that the predominance, so-called, is not in itself ever, in my opinion, evidence for conspiracy. You could also say that certain age groups predominate, for instance. Most leading people are of fairly advanced age, relatively speaking, rather than quite young. You could say, as Hitler did say in Germany, that Jews predominated, as indeed they did in many things, but it does not follow from that that they conspired to predominate. That is, that they engaged in some sort of group action for the sake of fostering each other's and furthering each other's career, acting together for some particular purpose, and so on, as he assumed from the mere fact that Jews were very prominent in it. It's similarly wrong to assume from the mere fact that males are predominant that they conspire for this purpose. I find no solidarity of interests. I find no acting together of males. I find no indication of conspiracy of any sort. I think they're divided by their different interests much more than they're held together. On the other hand, I also think that women do not act as a group, dominated or dominant. Again, they each identify not with other women, but with their family, class, local group, nationality, religion, and so on, just as men do. So I think the conspiracy theory doesn't help us very much. Now, as for the theory of there being differences, I do feel that there are, and I'm not sure why there are, but I do feel that there are, and I want to present a little bit of evidence along those lines. It is, of course, easily explained why women do not predominate if you accept any form of conspiracy theory or merely a form of social custom. It's fairly easily explained why women are not leading engineers. And you might very well say that one reason that they're not leading business executives is that they are not being promoted. I think there's something wrong with this idea, but it is not wholly implausible. And in a number of occupations and professions, until quite lately, women have simply not been accepted. Therefore, they could not predominate. All right, granted that much, it is still to be explained why they are of so little prominence in a number of occupations where clearly they have not only been accepted, but which have been for a long time regarded as a special province of women. If you consider, for instance, the arts, and more specifically music, you will find that women have for a long time been taught that music is the province, as it were, of women. Indeed, in this country, so much so that that music was considered somewhat sissy for men to engage in. One reason, incidentally, why in the musical occupations there are so many homosexuals, because a selective process took place. Well, you find women quite prominent in the performing musical arts. Great women singers. You might very well say that the absence of women conductors of any note may be due to male discrimination. Although among instrumentalists, they are also, except for the piano, not usually very prominent. But how is it to be explained that there are no women composers of note? I find it very hard to assume that there is a conspiracy, because if a woman composed a symphony and she felt nobody would accept it because it came from a woman, well, she could always use a male pseudonym after all. as in fact some woman writers did in the 19th century. There are no woman composers of note. Now, if you look at the other arts, this matter isn't quite that decisively so, but you have to admit that in poetry, in painting, and so on, women are certainly not prominent in proportion to their number. One of the earliest great poets, Sappho, was a woman, though a lesbian in more than one sense. She lived on the Lesbos and so on. But since then, even though poetry has been regarded again as a largely female province, there have been very few great female poets. There have been some. There have been very few female painters of note. So I come to the conclusion from all this that woman's creative ability, not performing but creative, distinguishing the arts into performing and creative, is considerably lower than that of men. And of course this then in turn will have to be explained. I have no full explanation for it, but my own feeling is very simply that women at some point or other seem to realize that they have a way of creating directly with their bodies, bearing other human beings and literally creating them, the male contribution to this matter being fairly minor, and that they in time seem to prefer to have children rather than brain children. Something that men simply can't have. I would say that because it would otherwise, since their heritage genetically must be the same as that of males, except for the sex difference, it would otherwise be hard to explain why that happens. I can't believe that it is cultural discrimination. In some fields, medicine, physics, the cultural discrimination against women was certainly much stronger than, say, in music, and we have great women physicists, and so on and so on. We don't have, relatively speaking, many great women creative artists. So my explanation then would be, I would apply this to a number of other fields. I would say that simply women are at some point or other not willing to use their ability in the same way men do, and that in turn would help us explain what is sometimes called employment discrimination and so on. It is perfectly true that a well-educated woman finds it harder on the job market to get the kind of job for which her education has prepared her than a man would. But I don't find it wholly unreasonable if employers are unwilling or reluctant to give her that kind of job for the very simple reason that they foresee, and I think they're statistically correct, that the woman after a while will interrupt her career. interrupt her career, and just when she starts to become useful to her employer, decide to get married and have children. Now, marriage and children does not necessarily prevent the pursuit of a career after a while, but it does interrupt it for something like 10 years or so, usually. And that 10-year interruption in the most productive time in terms of job achievement and so on can usually not be recovered. Therefore, you find a woman usually on a summit, to the extent to which they continue to have careers, to achieve something somewhat less in terms of prestige, power, advancement, and so on. Now, let me turn briefly to some people insist that for this reason, to make a woman more equal, as it were, the government, at the taxpayer's expense, should undertake to take care of children, of working mothers, and make it possible for them to pursue careers and so on. I'm a member of the American Sociological Association, which has just decided, I think the Eastern section has just decided, at the expense of the members of the association, for instance, and the next meeting to arrange for the sociological mothers or mother sociologists, whichever way you want it, to make sure to park their children at the expense of the association someplace so that they can take a part in the activities of the meeting. I voted against it, and I would vote against it in a very general sense to take care of children in any fashion whatsoever at taxpayers' expense. The reason for that is very simply, having children is not an act of God. Taxpayers do not benefit from children. On the contrary, I think, therefore, those who wish to have children voluntarily, it is not an act of God, it's not a disability that they can't help. Those who wish to have children for any reason whatsoever, and I find it hard to imagine what reason, should certainly, if they feel they benefit from having children, which must be the reason why they have them, they should certainly bear the expense. I have absolutely no objection to anyone having children or any other kind of pet. But I see no reason why taxpayers should be burdened with the support thereof. If indeed women feel that by having children they suffer in their careers and they prefer not to suffer in their careers, well, then they shouldn't have children. But I see no reason why they should have it both ways at someone else's expense. Incidentally, let me here mention very briefly, this is, you have to distinguish here, by the way, between the rights of mothers, and I think they have none as mothers, and the rights of children. Children, I think, should be possibly, if necessary, even, we have to do something for them, because unlike mothers, children did not decide to come into the world. I mean, the mother made a decision and should certainly bear the expense or suffer the consequences. But the child, from the viewpoint of fairness, since it had nothing to do with making the decision, if the mother, for one reason or other, is incapable of taking care of it, something has to be done. But here, I think our present welfare system simply omits the very most basic law of economics, that if you pay enough for something, people will supply it. So if you pay people enough for having children by means of aid to dependent children, then you will have more and more dependent children. A law that seems so simple that one hardly dares stating it, and yet I think it is the one explanation for the constant increase in the number of dependent children. Not necessarily in the number of children, but in the number of children who become dependent. And I have proposed in the past, and I've merely mentioned, that in this respect, it isn't really impossible to take appropriate measures. One appropriate measure to be taken would certainly be to inflict severe punishment on any male who contributes to the conception of a child when, at the time of conception, he can be shown to be either unwilling or unable to support that child. The willingness can always be shown later on by his actually supporting the child. If he can show at that time that he's really unable to, then the question arises, was that an act of God unforeseen, or was he at the time of conception unable to? This, please don't misunderstand me. The punishment I'm inflicting is for contributing to conception, not for having intercourse. The two things obviously are not the same. And I don't see any reason to punish people for having intercourse. Now, to return for a moment to laws, I should oppose strongly laws, some of which are still on the books in quite a number of states, which under the guise of protecting women and possibly protecting mothers, prohibit certain types of employment for them. In some states there cannot be barmaids, in other states they cannot work at night, and so on and so on. None of this, I think, is either necessary or required. None of this actually protects women, and some of it obviously may hinder employment that some of them may at least seek. On the other hand, laws that make congregation between men and women compulsory, I must say I never thought that any such law would really be necessary, but as a matter of fact, such laws are being proposed. There is one in New York City, for instance, that prohibits any bar, for instance, or place of public accommodation to discriminate between the sexes. So that is a matter of fact. You cannot have a bar in New York exclusively for males, or for that matter, exclusively for females. This seems utterly absurd to me. Utterly absurd because there are very clearly quite a number of bars who welcome both sexes. So if there is a bar also that wishes just one sex, whichever it is, I can't see the harm. It would be harmful. It would be discrimination in the sense of placing a group at a disadvantage. If all bars were to exclude one sex, assuming that going to a bar is a necessary and useful thing, then the sex that is excluded would have reason to complain. But this is not the case. Now, I don't quite see why it shouldn't be possible in some bars to be monosexual, if people so wish. They're not the kind of bars I myself would attend, but then I think it's a matter of taste. The same is true for employment or schools. It is entirely true that women, often for performing the same job, get lower wages. Although this is somewhat exaggerated, very often it isn't the same job, and the lower wage level of women is more often explained by their holding different jobs of somewhat lower qualification in most cases. For instance, many studies have been made of women getting lower pay in academic jobs, and these studies usually disregard the fact that most of the women, even women full professors, tend to be employed in colleges that pay less for one reason or the other. And that has not, I think, much to do with their sex, but a great deal to do with their qualification. It could be arranged, including the negative part. I should not oppose it at all. I spoke without differentiating. But let me point out that for practical purposes, any subsidy that goes to children is much more likely at this point to go to the children where it would be dysgenic, as you put it. That is, the subsidy very largely at the present time, for instance, for having children, goes to families whose children become dependent on the government and who are, in all likelihood, at the lower part of the intelligence scale and generally of social usefulness. And the very fact that they are brought up, the children are brought up under these circumstances, is likely to make them even less useful. So when I spoke against subsidizing children, I think you're right in correcting me that a subsidy may be useful if you could arrange it in such a way as to go to the right kind of families, but I had in mind the fact that it doesn't so go, but almost the other way around.
Wouldn't the best way to handle that, or one good way to handle that, be raise the income tax exemption? We assume there's a correlation, some kind of correlation, positive correlation between intelligence and the amount of money somebody makes. And those who make the most money, you'd want to encourage to have the most children. So that if you raise the exemption to $5,000 per child, you'd encourage wealthy people to have children, and the poor people are not going to pay taxes anyway.
But you see, as it seems to me that you have
four children.
Yeah. And you still have to prove that these are eugenic. But at any rate, it seems to me that you have. That your proposal suffers from its own virtues, so to speak. If you assume that the wealthy are brighter and they're bright enough to be wealthy, so I would tend to agree with you in this, in some sense at least, but you're assuming also that they're wealthy. You're assuming that they're wealthy. And if they're wealthy, the monetary incentive will be necessarily very small. So the chances are that your proposal wouldn't be effective except in the negative sense of penalizing those who are not wealthy. Even if you forgive me, it takes at least $20,000 or so to bring up a child. If you give a wealthy person a $5,000 exemption, I do not think that will lead him to have an additional child.
No, I mean for a year.
Well, possibly.
As a practical female, the first thing you have to do is to legalize abortion. You didn't have to do this.
Well, I'm all in favor of that. It has been done in some states, and where it is not legalized, it is still fairly getting to be cheap. I'm not only in favor of that, I'm in favor of doing, particularly making to poor people, doing much more to encourage them to engage in family planning, because as you certainly know, abortion is
probably the least acceptable way of population planning and should be used only as a backstop, so to speak, like that if another thing has not been done in time. So certainly such things as the pill and various other things are probably much better, and I'm all in favor of doing this. This is not a full-fledged population discussion, so I didn't go into the details, but I certainly would agree with you fully.
Many poor women are victims.
Well, I don't. The trouble is that I don't know to the extent to which victims anymore. I think if you had said that 20 years ago, I would have agreed much more wholeheartedly, but now we also actually lure them into having children by our welfare system.
A chappie made a suggestion in one of the Californian papers about a week ago to this effect that when a man gets married, he could sign a contract under which he would be exempted from income tax for the first year, but in return for that, he would contract out of any benefits whatsoever from government, from transfer payments for the children he has. In return for that, he sort of commits himself not to have other children. Well, if he does have as many children as he likes, but he's contracted out of getting any benefits for them.
This wouldn't help with the age of dependent children families, would it?
Mr. Prince,
it seems to me that we are falling victim to the persuasions of our opponents, namely that whenever something is wrong, government has to devise a program to support some and to penalize others. It seems to me that in this field, as in many others, nature and the market does what needs to be done. It is an invisible hand, although in this case, anatomically, the description may not be the term may not be correct. But there is certainly a working of nature and the invisible hand. In other words, when you say that we should, so our government should subvention the families which are healthy and have longevity and are hardworking, and you add all of that, and you have the description of a family of people of high intelligence who work hard, who are healthy, who live long, and a few other things, who are well able to support their children and don't need a government subvention. And in fact, would be very little influenced by government subvention. On the other hand, if you leave the penalty or the loan on those who produce children, but do not have these other qualities able to support them, rather than give them government support in proportion to the number of children they have, which we are doing at the present time, I think you again achieve the same result. In other words, if you let the forces of nature and the market work, you'll get exactly what is desirable. But whatever has been produced wrong, whatever has turned wrong, that, for instance, we have the large number of children among the low income, the less intelligent, and so on and so forth. That is a result of governmental activity. One of the most interesting things that happened within the past year is this. A Senate passed a bill on population control, appropriating $1.5 billion for population control. In the same session, the Senate, and that's where it started, the House went before it, A, increased the personal exemption for children, which of course is an encouragement to have more children. And number two, the man who proposed that thought that would continue his Senate career, fortunately, it ended 2 weeks ago, I mean Mr. Gore. And at the same session, Congress increased the benefits for children under some other programs. In other words, what it did is that it activated the heating plan and the air conditioning at the same time. So what we have to do, it seems to me, is not think of some new schemes to pay a subvention to the desirable children and discourage undesirable children, but rather let nature take its course in the market. Because what was discussed just a little bit earlier on the relative wages and compensation and how unfair it is here and there, again, In this case, the compensation is in terms of the productivity achieved. And as Professor Vandenhaeghe, of course, pointed out very well, if you set the wage above what the productivity, above what the market would pay, why, obviously, you will have discrimination. One way, you will just not hire them. If you set it too low, you'll have a surplus. So in other words, I strongly believe that if we just rely more on nature and the market, we'll get as desired results, and more desired results than if we try to corriger la fortune.
Well, let me answer this briefly, if I may. Then this young lady had raised her hand, and I think she should get precedence. But she speaks for an interest group.
That's right.
I certainly do agree with you that we should, unless a benefit is demonstrable, minimize government intervention. I certainly agree with you further, and I thought I had said so, that many of the present difficulties are caused by government intervention of the wrong case. I'm sorry, though, I cannot agree with you at all on your saying let nature take its course in general in this matter. You are simply wrong in your assertion that the poor would have fewer children and have had fewer children than the rich. This is simply not true. They have long before relief arrangements were made. The rate of childbearing among the poor was for the last 100 years in practically all countries much higher than among the rich. So it is not correct to say that this is due to our government encouragement. What our government encouragement has done is for the poor to have children and go on relief. That's quite a different matter. In other words, it has increased the number of dependent children. That it has increased the number of children is a different matter, and I doubt it. Now, it is in no way correct to say that by appropriate government intervention we cannot decrease the number of children. We can by making abortions available. It seems to me that if a woman wants an abortion and we make it available to her, we simply save a lot of money instead of bringing up a child that she doesn't want and that is not particularly useful to society. I think we should also make various birth control devices available, and I think in some cases we should follow the example of Denmark, which many people are very tempted to follow with respect to pornography, but are unwilling to follow with respect to sterilization. Denmark has had a sterilization program for many years, which has been used sparingly, but has been successful in this respect. Now, the idea of sterilization upsets many people because it is associated with the Nazis and so on. Of course, I do not propose anything like that. In Denmark, they do sterilize women who can be shown to suffer from hereditarily transmitted defects of certain kinds. I think this would be a perfectly reasonable program, and if you call it intervention, then I'm in favor of intervening along those lines. We intervene in many other ways. We intervene in the sense of putting some people in prison. Nature doesn't put anyone in prison, even if you murder someone. Well, I'm in favor of putting murderers in prison, and so on and so on. I certainly agree with you again that some things that we make crimes shouldn't be made crimes, but I think you go too far if you simply say we're not to intervene.
Couldn't you tie in sterilization with welfare?
Yes,
in other
I
words,
would be delighted to do that.
Condition, or, as India has slightly tried and should do far more of, to put a premium on vasectomy. In other words, he gets 100 or 200 rupees. That
I'd be delighted to do that.
Not only the number, but the quality. In other words,
yes.
Those at the very lowest level are more likely to be induced by 100 or 200 rupees. To have a vasectomy performed.
I'm so glad to have persuaded you.
took only a moment.
This is some sort of government intervention, and I'm in favor of that. And so are you, so we are in agreement.
May I point out, I'm Hutt from Cape Town and from the Hoover Institution and Cal State College at the moment. There's a certain semantic difficulty here which I should draw attention to. I myself have advocated non-discrimination. And one or two things I've written, I've suggested that the small group of private people who form governments and who are necessarily entrusted with great powers should have no power to discriminate. Now, as I've used that phrase, I've meant something pretty clear. I've argued even further that they themselves should prevent discrimination. By that, I don't mean choosing one's friends, one's club, any interference by government with private individual choice at all, but a law which prevents, say, women from doing any job for which the management would find them competent and would wish to use them. Any such law is indeed, in my opinion, the type of discrimination which must be forbidden. Yeah. Similarly, if indeed there is a, through private use of coercive power, women or Negroes or any other class are prevented from doing any type of work which managements would find it profitable to offer them, that then it's the duty of the state, the duty of government, to intervene and to suppress that discrimination. I take, for example, the case of women in typesetting. In Britain in the 1890s, a very large proportion of the typesetters in Britain, compositors we called them there, were women. This was at the time that the linotype and monotype were coming in, setting type by hand. At that stage, the union decided they had to end the discrimination against women. Equal pay for equal work. They brought the women in. The women became members of the union, and all the feminists put up their hands and said, "Hallelujah. At last, the discrimination has been ended. Women are now being treated fairly." Not another woman compositor was taken on, but the last one died in 1924. You can find the history of all this in hidden away, not prominent in the Webb's two books, History of Cradenism and Industrial Democracy. That all happened. Now, that was a case of discrimination. And discrimination of that kind is the sort of thing which I personally, when I have advocated that in good government discrimination is constitutionally outlawed, that is what I've had in mind. Where the United States has gone wrong in discrimination is to insist that there shall be no such thing as a club for blacks only, or for whites only, or for Jews only, or for women only, or for men only. The suggestion there's something immoral about a club which admits only juveniles, because that's unfair, because it's an age discrimination. And age discrimination economically can be quite important, quite unjust. Keeping the young back, for example, where some unions have got constitutions which are intended to keep the young back, keep progress back, and so forth. And so I think one's got to be very clear about the various meanings of the word discrimination. The sort of discrimination which I've always suggested ought to be outlawed is the type which is grossly unfair to some, obviously grossly unfair, we can all see that, to some class or group.
Yes, Mrs. Boggs.
I had some questions with your premise as to the comparative productivity of women and men. And in large measure, it seems to me that certain patterns have been set up as a result of willingness on the part of women working a supplemental wage earners to earn less or accept less in the way of wages than their male counterparts. And frankly, it seems to me that if a rational market approach were taken in terms of evaluation of actual productivity, then perhaps more egalitarian in the sense of fairness of wages would result. And I think that in a pure productivity analysis, I'm not sure that you would get the wage disparity.
But you see, wages are not settled just by productivity, as certainly you will tell me. Wages are settled by supply and demand. Now, you have yourself already explained why women are paid less. Namely, they may be available at lower wages, for instance, because they want to locate where their husbands or families are. there may be therefore a surplus in that location of female labor, who, as you say, may very well be quite as productive as male labor, but as a result of the relatively high supply will be paid less. I cannot see that any law would change it.
I'm not
denying that women can be in many jobs as productive as men. In some jobs, they're 100% more productive, for instance, childbearing. But other jobs, of course, the difference is likely to be individual. The only general point I made is that employers may be less inclined to hire women for long careers because they foresee, and they're statistically correct, that women are likely to interrupt the careers when men are not. So that they're a fairly bad investment in this sense.
You have to weigh against that the likelihood of men to change positions.
Yeah.
Because of opportunities in other
areas. It's true, and as a matter of fact, I think we are not behaving fully rationally. On the other hand, to put it this way, for instance, we are paying as much for the college education of women as we do for the college education of men, subsidizing it to the same degree, when it's entirely clear that the returns on women are far less. So in other words, you may, if you want to put it this way, say that in some cases women are underpaid in terms of this analysis, in other cases they are overfavored. And I really don't see that there's much to be done about it. Moreover, I feel that the individual woman who is really resolved on making a career has usually been quite able to overcome these obstacles. That is, I do not believe, say, in the fields with which I'm more familiar, say, in the academic field, that a woman who is really outstanding in any field that I know of has any difficulty in getting a university job because she is a woman. If she is not outstanding, if she is run-of-the-mill, and the department chairman has a choice between hiring a man and a woman, he very often will prefer a man for a variety of reasons. One reason, that the man is likely to stay in the career. You're quite right, he has no guarantee that he will stay with the department, but at least he will stay in the career. You see, in the case of a woman, in other words, there are two possibilities. A, she will leave the employment. B, she will leave the whole career. And you're not quite right in comparing that with a man, because it's true that the man may also leave this particular job, but he's not likely to leave the career.
But
so the woman has two strikes, the man
at
one.
Advantage to that employer?
He thinks that way.
From his point of view, it would seem to me he'd really care whether somebody was going to stay on his job.
No, but I think you're wrong in terms of probability statistics. I mean, if there are two reasons for which a woman may leave the job, A, that she leaves the career, B, that she gets a better job elsewhere. And for a man, there's only one reason for leaving the job. Clearly, the employer feels that the woman is somewhat less to be counted on. He's right.
No.
If I can
interrupt.
You
have to weigh the percentage probability that the woman will want to leave that job.
Yeah. If you're assuming that women are less job hopping than men are, in general.
Yes, that there are reasons why women would be more likely to stay in a given location.
No, they may be even less likely.
And so on.
But I'd put it the other way around. I don't think so. I think women may be in a given location because of family responsibilities, but they're not less likely to leave it. If the husband, in other words, for instance, if a woman is employed by an employer, her reasons for leaving the job are possibly, like a man's, that she's getting a better offer. Secondly, her husband is getting a better offer somewhere else. Although she likes the job, she wants to follow her husband. Thirdly, she wants to have a child. In other words, women have additional reasons for being less reliable in terms of career from the employer's viewpoint than men have. A man is not leaving the job because his wife is getting a better offer somewhere else.
Second, that if you did an analysis, which is really actually what is required from the employer's point of view, as to the people in his locality applying for jobs, and as to their relative likelihood of staying in those positions, he would then be approaching the problem in a more rational approach. From a more rational basis
of
making his selection.
But, I just want to add one point here. I spoke of productivity as a very separate issue. The issue of jobs is quite on the lines that you have indicated. Now, what you're saying, if I understand you correctly, is given these various variables, nonetheless, one ought to look empirically at the matter and so on. And empirically, what you're saying is that the employer would find that women are just as, or perhaps even more, likely to stay with the job than men are. If that were so, and I have not made this inquiry, if that were so, the question arises, why are employers that irrational? Unless you assume a conspiracy theory, I think you are admitting that they would be acting economically irrationally, and I don't see why they should. Most employers I know sort of like girls a lot.
May I make a very short comment on this? The economics of it is very simple. In any just market, in any fair market, work of equal value, of equal quantity and equal value, will be remunerated at the same rate. There will be no differentiation. In the free market, it's colorblind, sex blind, and so forth. When you buy a product, you don't ask what was the color or sex or religion of the person who made it. You ask, is it good value for money? Therefore, there's a very strong loss avoidance, profit-seeking incentive to be colorblind and sex-blind. In a good market, free market, a work of equal productivity will receive equal remuneration. The difficulty arises that in the case of women's work, there's an extra cost of employing them as a rule. The same thing arises in the employment of Negroes and non-whites, where the whites are concerned. The prejudices of the others, those of the different sex come in. But also there are other reasons why it's more expensive in business. The cost of employing women is greater, and that makes it essential in women's interest that they should be prepared not to regard it as unjust when they are hired at lower rates of pay. There are all sorts of reasons why, for example, there might be a local penny team of women for work because their husbands, whose incomes are greater than theirs anyhow, are stationed in that particular district. They could get more if they could move away, but they can't move away. But it's just profitable to employ them because they happen to be there. I've known many cases of this where women have been employed at relatively low salaries. They get very much higher salaries elsewhere. But the employers, say a university, has had a junior lectureship available, not a senior lectureship or a professorship. And this woman has been there, she's been the best applicant for a low grade post, and she gets it. When she gets it, she's very apt to say, but I'm underpaid. But you see, the funds available were not sufficient to employ somebody of high grade. They've got one person or two persons of high grade. They don't want a third one. But they have got a junior post, and for the junior post, she would have been the best applicant. There was no discrimination against her in that case.
I think there's a gentleman in the way in the back who's been waiting for about half an hour.
I'm Danny Mize. I'd like to go back to Professor Freeman's point because I think that I've been rather disappointed in a good deal of this session at least. I think we have let arguments get by which in other contexts we would not have permitted at all. I think to start with Mr. Wilde's argument that in meetings of this sort, we have so consistently pointed out how a governmental body is frequently, if not always, unable to make the correct, quote, distinctions or to follow its professed purposes. To think that a governmental program would correctly identify those that Mr. Wilde thinks should be helped and those it thinks should be hurt, I think that we would not accept that, in addition to the question of whether in any circumstance we think that a government program should come along and penalize those who are considered to fail on some scale and help those who would be better on that criterion. Mr. Gilman's point, for the tax exemption, I'd like to nail this down economically because I think Professor Vandenhag, when he finally heard the amount, was less against it than despite Mr. Gilman's point, that the poor don't really pay any taxes, the level of poorness at which you don't pay any income tax at all is quite low, and is only in the event that you took something like Mr. Gilman's very high exemption that you would be knocking out most of the population from paying taxes, which would certainly increase the stimulation for anyone at any reasonable economic level to to not have children. And finally, I think that Professor Vandenhaag's point, in which he seemed to equate the society in Denmark, as I understood it, compulsorily sterilizing people who were considered to be defective on some scale with societies placing murderers in prison, seems to me to be a point that I at least could not accept. I was not under the impression that failing below someone's determined scale was a crime against someone else in the society in the way that, let us say, a murder is. Now, I can understand that at various points we may feel certain frustrations about the effect of present government programs and the ill effects they have may have brought about, but I think that to encourage in different ways similar types of programs simply to counterbalance that is, as Professor Freeman said, taking our opponent's arguments and method of argument and values and adopting them, which is something I don't think we should do.
Well, let me briefly answer that. I think you undoubtedly got the better over an argument that you attributed to me. The only difficulty is I didn't ever present that argument, and I wouldn't. I certainly don't equate people being poor or mentally deficient with having committed a crime. This business of intervening to put people in prison, I merely mentioned to point out to Professor Freeman that we do intervene in a variety of circumstances, and I think he agrees. And that said, there was no intention to compare mental deficiency with committing a crime. I would, though, perfectly be willing to say, as the Danes are, and in fact they have been fairly successful in this, as the statistics indicate, that a program of compulsory sterilization of mentally deficient females is likely to reduce the crime rate very considerably. And I'm very much in favor of such a program, which is not the same as the Nazis did at all. Let me say once more, mentally deficient persons must, by definition, be regarded as unable to give their consent to conception or sexual intercourse. If, therefore, though we can't make the sexual intercourse impossible, we make the conception impossible, then it is predictable that the mental deficiency or defect is hereditary and that the child ensuing from it would be a burden on society and possibly injurious to it, seems to me entirely justifiable. And it seems to me that the Danes are right. And incidentally, they have achieved, and they're about the only country in the world that has achieved a reduction in the crime rate in the last 15 years. Quite exceptionally, and I think I would connect that with this particular, very sparsely applied sterilization program. But even though rather few people are sterilized, these few people who are sterilized probably would have accounted for a considerable amount in the offspring of crime, which is probably what explains reduction in the crime rate. Now, the other thing, point that you made, Mr. Boggs, namely the difficulty of identifying those citizens whose offspring should be fostered and so on, and those whose offspring should not be fostered. As for though the last, I think we have already indicated with respect to sterilization, and in general, we simply would stop subsidizing it, which isn't the same as taking a positive measure. But Mr. Wilde's identification, I don't think, offers the difficulties that you are speaking of, because Mr. Wilde did not propose that the government should select and say, you ought to have offspring and you ought not to, or something like that. He proposed simply that we take certain entirely external measures as indications and treat people in class terms, not on an individual basis, but in class terms, favorably or unfavorably in terms of taxes and subsidies. This is not only not impossible, it seems to me a perfectly possible thing to do. And I don't see your difficulties in selecting. If we set a general criterion and say for these people we would make certain tax concessions and so on, for other people we would not, I don't see any great difficulty. Finally, with respect to Mr. Gilman's proposal of subsidies and so on, I hadn't given the matter sufficient thought to come to
a full conclusion, but the threat that you have in mind, that so many people would stop having children as a result of the tax advantages of not having children, that the government's revenue would greatly decline, that threat, did I understand you correctly?
No.
Okay, please correct me then.
I find that the question being that if with that large tax exemption, mm-hmm. with even the present normal amount of children, the government's tax collections would decline. In other words, if you have a $5,000 exemption per year per child.
A child that you don't have.
No, he wanted it for children that you do have, so that rich people would have an advantage to have the children. So he was advocating it per child that you did have.
Uh-huh.
That's the reason you didn't understand
that. I see. I did not understand him in the first place, so I'll just withdraw from it.
Well, I think Mr. Well has a comment, and then I'd like to ask Dr. Wiggins to sum up. I see he's been taking notes there. And then we can knock off for lunch,
right,
Mr. Wheel.
I'm
going
to make
wow.
this brief. You, I think, handled a rebuttal on this point very effectively, but I want to add 2 points. First, the propaganda we have had and the debates still in relation to ecology, not here, Americans, and the population explosion has been so undifferentiated that we tend to believe that reducing the birth rate per se is desirable, where actually there is a great deal of room on top for people with superior abilities. This is the reason for advocating what I'm talking about, whether it is practical or not. As far as Mr. Freeman's point about laissez-faire is concerned, this is very fine if we lived in a laissez-faire economy. We don't. We live in an economy in which groups with coercive monopoly powers, such as plumbers, can earn more than most writers and most college professors. And consequently, the natural aristocracy, to use Jeffersonian term, and I do not mean the plumbers, different to any plumbers that may be here, the natural aristocracy find it hard to reproduce at the rate they should in the interests of society. The third point is that given a world and national population problem, the question of whether a child is to be brought into the world cannot, for very long, be a matter of individual decision, because the state must consider the probability that that child will be a public burden because of incapacity or other tendencies. And I'd like to make one final quick point about the young lady's discussion. I think that the answer given about the disabilities of women, their tendency toward pregnancy, so forth, is quite relevant to a differential, but it does not in the least explain why the differential has been increasing in favor of men over the past 20 years and markedly, since I believe women got pregnant during both periods.
Well, I think we have just one more young lady before we turn to Dr. Wiggins to give her a chance.
I find myself agreeing substantially with many of the points raised by virtually everyone who's spoken out. In different ways. I mean, I agree with Professor Vandenhaag that laws aren't really going to correct the situation any more than they have in the instance of racial discrimination. It has to be corrected insofar as it can be corrected by changing opinion rather than just passing laws which then won't be enforced and won't be obeyed. I would point out that there are a couple of statistics that were not mentioned that favor women in employment situations, one of which is that contrary to widespread popular opinion, they tend to miss less time on a job than men do. And that should be considered in deciding whether it is economically feasible to hire a woman for a job, and I think frequently it is not considered. And also, I think that many women, those who are career-oriented and who really want to excel in whatever their field may be, will work harder at it than the men because they know they are up against this discrimination, and they know they have to be not only good, but unusually good in order to get anywhere. Then I do want to call attention for a moment to the one area that has not been considered, and that is the situation confronting the single woman who is self-supporting as opposed to the woman who is working a second income for the family. She shares with the single man a tax disadvantage, which is being remedied slowly but surely by tax reform, but it's a slow process. She may be looked at with some suspicion by prospective employers or co-workers if she's over the age of about 21 or 22 and isn't married. They wonder why. She may be expected to marry by an employer who then decides she is not a good employment risk. And she is frequently paid less than the male occupying the same sort of position. So she's under, despite the fact that her educational expenses have been just as heavy as the man's, and her living expenses are probably very close to his heavy and sometimes even heavier than the man. So she's at a sizable economic disadvantage that is not shared by the married woman who is simply working to provide extra income for her family. And that's something I think we failed to get into this morning, and I know this is the last moment, and therefore we're not going to get into it, and I thought I ought to throw it out anyway.
Dr. Wiggins, perhaps you would care to sum up your thoughts?
I would like to talk with you for a moment after our session because I find it impossible to agree with everything that has been said. I understood that, and I'm sure you know that I did. I think summing up is something that we will all have to do for ourselves, but rather than interrupting as the discussion was proceeding, I made a few notes, and I would like to put these in the hopper at least. I would like to make a plea for the survival of morons. Also, university professors, of course. I was reminded during that particular discussion, I believe in Sweden several years ago, they discovered that they had been too successful in encouraging the morons, we might say, to reproduce. And old Gunnar Myrdal was right there and managed to furnish incentives, which I think have rectified that situation. But basically, I do agree. I happen personally to be strongly in favor of sterilization rather than abortion. I realize that people are not likely to think too far ahead under some circumstances, but maybe abortion is a little too expensive if sterilization can be arranged aforetime. I do understand, perhaps you all read this, that in good old New York City, now people are getting their appointments before they're pregnant.
I wish you were right. I really wish you were right. As a matter of fact, let me interrupt you. Unfortunately, owing to sabotage by the city administration and others, many women who are pregnant in the first few weeks of their pregnancy are kept waiting so long to get their appointments.
So it's difficult to say whether they were pregnant.
It is very hard for them to get the abortion. It becomes dangerous, and in some cases, it's no longer feasible. I wish you were right on this. That would be a good idea to get before.
Maybe she should have had the date after the appointment.
Well, that was what I thought I had read, but I see I'm incorrect in detail here, although it is a kind of fuzzy area where it's difficult to be sure. With regard to the general unhappiness and frustration, which I think is justifiable in many of our women, I'd like to invite your attention to a book. I don't know what my colleague here thinks of the book, but I found it very interesting. A book by a woman, a sociologist, named Bigelow, called The Feminized Male. It may be that some of our women protesters feel that there is now no really significant difference, and certainly this author would say so, except in the purely physiological area. Therefore, they are in a fresh way entitled to equal treatment. Why are men in charge of things and women are controlled by men? I'm sure that Ernest is aware of the great anthropologist Ralph Linton, who had a very short answer for this question. As a general rule, men can beat up women. As a general rule. Somehow women have come to believe this. So thank God we do not have to prove it anymore. May I make one final comment? This little thought occurred to me several years ago. I believe there was some discussion at Harvard about the eating clubs. I'm not sure that's the exact title of the group, but there was some question about the unwillingness of some clubs to admit persons of certain types or certain categories. And I thought about it for a moment and realized that it is an impossible task. Let me close with this. I want to belong to a group which will not accept people like me. If I am successful, I fail. It is impossible for me to belong to any group which excludes people of my type. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wiggins and Dr. Vandenhaag. We went over a little bit over our allotted time, but I think obviously the interest in this particular discussion was probably worth it. I think Ed Filner probably has an announcement to tell us where we can eat,
yes,
because I don't know, and I'd like to know.